Hello, and welcome to the fifth night of Millennial 8. I have four streams tonight, and in 2 hours it will be Garrod Murphy, then Ricardo Deschene, and then Semiogog. But first, I'm here with Martin Selner. And Martin Selner, people have asked me to invite Martin Selner in the past, we have been in contact, but for various reasons it hasn't happened until now. So I'm very glad to have Martin Selner on Millennial at last. It's a very high-profile guest. So Martin, welcome to Millennial.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here with you.
Excellent. I could introduce you, but I think it's usually better if the guest introduces themselves, just for those who aren't familiar with their work. Obviously, people will have heard of Generation Identity. Would you like to talk about your involvement in that and what you're doing now?
Yeah, my name is Martin Selner. I'm an Austrian activist, I would also say journalist and author. And maybe people in the Anglosphere know me for my involvement in Generation Identity, a big pan-European identitarian youth movement that was started in the early 2010s, like 12, 13, 14. The breakthrough appeared in 16, 17, 18, especially with the different Europe missions and actions. And then there was a big phase of repression and adaptation to the whole issue. And I'm still very much involved in activism, political organization. I had a YouTube channel, now I have a Telegram and Odyssey channel, and I'm working on those fields also in theory and writing books, writing for several magazines, right-wing magazines in Germany, and still try to organize right-wing activism on the streets.
And you have been courageous, and I'm not just saying this because you're on Millennial, but you have been really punished for your activism with GI in Austria and elsewhere. I think you've suffered more than most people. So there's a lot. There are a lot of people who really admire you for the sacrifice that you've made and the spirit that you've shown in all of this. I think it's quite incredible, really. How much, because other people, we both know many people who have suffered a lot for standing up for, against mass immigration and so on. What would you say is the situation? Well, first of all, how do you deal with that? How do you find the resources to deal with what they put you through?
Yeah, it's been kind of rough for a while, especially in 2018-19, where we had a lot of house raids and a lot of trials. There's still a lot of civil lawsuits. But I think a lot of people notice by now, especially, I would say, the repression in America against the people who protested on January 6th, but also the COVID regime in Canada, now showed a lot of people the teeth of this so-called democracy, liberal democracy. So I think we are a bit of an avant-garde when it came to this repression. Particularly annoying is the censorship since 2018. GI censored, but I myself also censored, I would say, in the Alex Jones and Fuentes fashion, which were also posting images or videos from me gets your account canceled. And I would say, I think that's where I'm leading. I got my 50th bank account canceled 2 weeks ago. So it's kind of a bank odyssey I'm on. That's don't even talk about PayPal and all this kind of stuff. That's a bit annoying also when you look for a flat or just every normal everyday life routines. They get a bit problematic if you put your name in Google and then you're portrayed as reborn totalitarian dictator and evil impersonated. That's a bit annoying, I have to agree. But also, I don't try or like to lament too much about it because still, although we are, I would say, the utmost opposition of the system, of the global elite, I'm still able to run around freely. I have a wife, I have a child. I'm sitting now in my heated office in spite of the war and the sanctions, and we can have a stream together. So I think there's still a lot of freedom. There's still a lot of space to do and to act. And I can say to everybody who's watching, for all the negative things I experienced, there are a lot of positive things. For all the attacks I got a lot of support, and I'm very grateful for that. So I would say, in sum, it was still a good decision to show a face and to get active. And I would encourage everyone to do that. to do that, I think if you really do it and if you go all in, for every repression, there also comes a lot of support.
Right. Okay. What would you, that's a very positive message there. What would you say about comparing today, 2022, with 2017? I would say that was the high point of identitarianism, or at least so far, that's been the highest point of identitarianism. In America, there was the alt-right that carried over to Britain. But then also across Europe, there was the identitarian movement as well, and various other organizations. I was going to conferences a lot. I know that you certainly were as well. There was a whole ecosystem there. And I think that is partly the censorship was designed to dismantle all of that as much as to silence us individually online. What would you say is the situation? Do you think it's better or worse now with the censorship? One thing I would say is I'm kind of glad to be banned from YouTube now and Twitter, because it means I don't need to worry about that. What would you say about that?
I agree with you. There's some kind of a freedom. And I'm also very glad that I was boosting my Telegram channel very early, so I could save some of my subscribers on Telegram. But still, the problem is, if you are a movement, an activist movement, a youth movement, and you are barred from social media, it's very hard to grow. So obviously, all these astroturfed movements, Black Lives Matter, now we have this last generation Extinction Rebellion. Without social media, it would be gone in a few weeks, especially because it's hard to get your message across, recruit new members, get funding for activism and for lawsuits. And after this big censorship wave, then we had a lot of repression waves. This was a bit complicated. Also, we had to change this typical NGO approach of GI. In that sense, doesn't work anymore. Plus, it also is just too costly if everybody shows its face and makes a banner drop, because this now always leads to civil lawsuits. There was an action where people just handed out leaflets, and then they had to pay like 1,000 euro each for a cease and desist. So it's really crazy the amount of money you have to pay. So that's why I would say the identitarian activism in Europe in facing this repression went a bit more underground, became pluralistic, and thus less visible on an international point of view. So for example, the movement in France was actually banned as the only movement. In Austria in 21, our logo, the Lambda, got banned, but which is also problematic. We had to delete all old videos, all social media posts, everything. Like we had ourselves what survived the censorship, we had to purify it from the internet, because we also would have to pay like 2,000 euros for every single Lambda that we post online. And so at the moment, there's a plurality of smaller, independent, identitarian groups, very local, with local identities, doing actions, posting those actions on different activist blogs, a structure that resembles a bit to the Antifa. But still, the action goes on, but it's less visible on a global scale. Also, since we are not organizing these big global actions like Defend Europe again. But maybe this will come in the future. It depends on the repression, and it depends on how the situation develops.
And do you think that the state is showing more or less desire to repress this kind of thing?
I would say the desire for repression is growing and growing, especially now in Germany, because in Germany we have a very left-wing government. And maybe, did you hear about the coup attempt of the royal?
Yes. I wasn't sure whether that was real or not, because some people were saying this is obviously staged.
Did you ever talk about it on the Millennial, or do you want to hear the whole story behind it? So
yeah, tell the story. Yeah.
Yeah, brace yourselves. Okay, so it's a huge coup. It's one of the biggest anti-terror organizations in the history of the German government. And the average age of the people who attempted the coup is, I think, 67. The prince and the leader is also 70-something. They had no real plans. They made 150 house raids and fought almost just a few weapons, a little bit of money. Nothing is found there. And then they presented some prepping utensils, like canned food and stuff like that, as if something crazy. That's why in Germany now everybody on the right calls it the ravioli coup, because like they found this ravioli and everybody's just completely making fun about it. They didn't find anything. It was just a group of old and angry boomers, you know, who were fantasizing about reinstating the a royal to the throne, because what's QAnon in America is the so-called Reichsbürger, the Reichs citizen movement here. They claim that the state of Germany doesn't really exist, but the German Empire lives on legally. And so everything you have to do is somehow create a new constitution or dismantle the old one. They differ here a bit, you know, and with this legalistic ritual, suddenly the legitimacy of the German government will crumble. And from one day to another, we have a German empire from 1860 again. So that's basically their idea. It's a bit like, works a bit like the QAnon hopium. And most of these people are just a bit, you know, like, I would say they're more funny than dangerous. And there was no real danger from the beginning. The whole thing was planned 2 weeks in advance. All of the state media and private media were informed. So they were waiting with the cameras in front of the houses. So they informed the press about it. And then just one day after, they proclaimed that there will be a new weapons law, which is very strict. Plus, there will be a new law for all people working for the state, judges, police officers, teachers, that if there's just a suspicion of them being right-wing, they will be thrown out and they have to prove the opposite. So the burden of proof is turned around, and they're now trying to ban the AfD. So that's the state of repression in Germany. They're just inventing threats, creating huge terror ops, and then trying to hit the AfD.
There seems to be something that's becoming a typical tactic nowadays, where a threat is massively exaggerated. And they'll find one example at this group here. They exaggerate what that group is doing, the possible threat that that group poses. And then that justifies new laws that will affect everybody. This seems to be something that is happening more and more. And I remember hearing the term, well, anarcho-tyranny was one term that was being thrown around in 2018. And then also soft totalitarianism, where they do things like this. And it's not exactly 1984. It's not exactly the Soviet Union. But it's almost... Well, it's like Trudeau's Canada. It's more like that, where it's polite and gentle and sort of even effeminate, but it's thorough, it's rigorous and ruthless. Mm-hmm. And it really does stifle any dissent. I mean, basically, we seem to be looking at a power structure that absolutely does not want to give up anything and will imprison people, change the laws, make things up in order to maintain its hold on power.
I agree. I think it's a soft totalitarianism. I also use this term very often because I would say it's a totalitarian regime. Why? Because a totalitarian regime has the characteristic of not letting any opposition really happen unless it's controlled opposition. And there's no area where opposition can really gather and organize. And like in the DDR, they crushed every opposition movement. That's the same here in a way, but it's softer, since they're creating kind of niches where a fake opposition or like a pseudo opposition can happen. And also, I think what they really like to do is the tactic of thousand stitches, you know, where they like make you bleed out and give up on your own, because then they can prove there's no real totalitarianism. They give up themselves. So I think the smart way to do it in a way is to force them to become more and more openly totalitarian, but in a way that they are overreacting and they are letting the mask drop. So that's a very tough thing to do. It's kind of being on the razor's edge, because if you give them like any kind of reason to become totalitarian, even if it's a completely fake ravioli coup like those Reichsbürger, then you're legitimizing them in a way. So you just have to increase peaceful, nonviolent, approachable activism and presence, also like streams and a counter public, to make them more and more totalitarian. I think that's the only way to demask the system and to demask the soft totalitarianism. And most importantly, don't give up. Because if you give up because of this being weighed down by this financial, moral, emotional pressure, then they win, because then you gave up on your own and they didn't have to enforce the rules on you. That would be like my opinion on this term of the soft totalitarianism.
Yeah, it's a sick thing to do, really, isn't it? To wear people down so that they will eventually just give up of their own accord. So then they don't become a martyr. They don't go to prison or have some heroic showing. Instead, they just fade away. They just stop. They shut down that Twitter account or that Telegram channel, and people eventually forget about them. And then the whole thing has been sort of for nothing. But they drive people to do that because you simply can't have a normal life. This can be overstated, but it can be understated as well. I mean, I think that people should be aware of what they take on when they rebel against the mainstream. It's the mainstream is very good at punishing you for doing that in various ways. I'm not trying to discourage people. I'm just saying be aware of what you're getting into. You will not have a normal life. I mean, Martin and I, neither of us is going to have a normal life ever because of what we've done. And that's not the end of the world. Maybe you don't want a normal life.
The very important thing is also that they never forget. So the internet never forgets and they just keep it up. So that's very true. You're very right about that. People really have to be aware of that. And it's also important for me to make every activist aware of that. And everybody who wants to show his face has to know the consequences. But still the problem is, I think it's still important that people really show their face and go in the public. And I think this was, for example, one of the very important breakthrough moments of the alt-right or generation identity in Europe, that a lot of people showed their face and in a way created a new vision and a new archetype of the activist, of the right-winger, that was more approachable and didn't fit the cliches of the media. And I think what a big problem right now is that organizing on the ground, being active on the ground, has reduced, at least in Europe. And people are feeling very well in their online personalities, in their online anonymous fake avatar characters. I get it, of course. Nobody should dox themselves without any necessity. But also it encourages people to say absolutely stupid and like useless things that they would never say with their face or in public. And so I have the feeling that a lot of people who don't take part in activism, especially the Zoomer generation. Like if you look at rallies from the right, whether it's America or Europe, it's the boomers going on the street for the rights and for the countries, while the Zoomers are not so eager to do that. And if you basically have a liberal life and a hedonistic life and a complete conformistic life, then you use this online personality and online presence as a pressure valve. And that's something that I'm seeing increasing a bit right now, you know, a radicalization online, but a moderation offline. So that's how I would summarize it.
Yeah, this is something, ironically, this is something that Jordan Peterson has been complaining about recently, that people on the internet are anonymous, and so they say cruel things. I mean, I realize you're making a different point. And I've heard people on our own side saying this before. I've made the point myself that, for example, in America, I think the First Amendment is as much a curse as a blessing, because it means people can just say insane things that are completely over the top, irrational, bad optics, to say the least, stuff that isn't even helpful. They do it because they can do it, because the First Amendment gives them that ability. Now, I'm not against freedom of speech at all, and I think I wish we all had the First Amendment, but I think the cost of it is this. And then online, everyone has the First Amendment, at least in theory, because you can use sock accounts and whatever, and you'll never get found out. So online, everyone has this freedom to just say crazy stuff. And it does end up playing into the hands of activist groups who are trying to shut down freedom of speech online, which is, you go.
No, you're completely right. And there was a report in Germany, very interesting report, a few months ago. I made a video about it, where an insider talked to the press about the Telegram unit of the German secret police. It wasn't a leak, so she just gave an interview. And there's a huge building somewhere near Berlin where they have a huge office complex where you only have people of the secret service creating Telegram accounts, being Telegram group chats. They even have their own makeup people and their own like archive of costumes, because then they make a lot of photos, because if you post a photo, then you're a real person. And they just take some amateurish photos somewhere in everyday situation, create different identities, run on a different identities. And what they're doing, they have a clear strategy, like they are LARPing as hard right people, esoteric people, whatever. For every niche, they have a kind of personality, and then try to befriend people in the circles of important people. And then over these friends, they get to these important people and try to get into chat groups. And they are allowed to commit thought crimes. So they're allowed to commit typical thought crimes for the scene. So those people, like when you see those people LARPing online, you never know in Germany if it's a fad or a real person. But I think that's the same in the UK, isn't it? Or
yes, it is. And this is why we have the expression fed posting, because exactly. often it's a fed saying this stuff. But I haven't heard about a costume department and makeup. That was why I laughed there. It's so ridiculous. But from their point of view, I can understand that's a good tactic. You want to get right in and make it as convincing as possible, befriend people. And, you know, it's amazing to think of how much time and money and effort they must put into this, trying to get us to be bad optics and trying to get us to say crazy stuff that they can use against us. You mentioned Extinction Rebellion before, mm-hmm. and I find Extinction Rebellion very interesting because it's the absolute, well, I think it's the absolute opposite of what we do. Not that I'm an activist like yourself, but it's all connected. Extinction Rebellion, and there's an offshoot, Animal Rebellion. I think there's another one, Just Stop Oil. All of these things. What would you say about these groups, these organizations?
Yeah, I mean, hard to say. If you look at where they're funded and who pays for them, you know, you clearly see that there are certain NGOs paying for them. I would say to a certain extent, they're definitely astroturfed and globalistic conformist revolutionaries. So they're not real rebels. In Austria and Germany, these organizations have been very active this autumn. They've been starting to gluing themselves on the streets. I don't know if you had the same in the UK.
Yeah.
And this is an action where you really piss off everyday people. And normally revolutionaries need to befriend everyday people. They have to be seen like Robin Hoods, pissing off the rich and the elites. And they are pissing off the normal people, hated by the normal people, and only supported by elite journalists, elite influencers, elite scientists, you know. So they really seem like, I wouldn't say it, they seem like the avant-garde of the elite protesting for the great reset to take place quicker and more thorough. So that's how I would see them. Although I have to say still, it's an interesting development because they also damage Antifa very much in Germany, because the youth now goes to this movement. For them, right, a bash to fash becomes a side issue. So obviously they're all left wing, but they don't protest so much against the AfD or anything else anymore. So Antifa really has a recruitment problem and really is very annoyed by this new big issue on the left. By the way, we made a very funny action last week on Thursday. It made the headlines in Austria, like regionally, where we basically made an Extinction Rebellion action. Yeah, so we said in Germany it's Aufstand gegen das Aussterben, Extinction. We said rebellion against the extinction of the Austrians. We had it on a banner. And we had like little posters with the slogan stop man-made demographic change. So that's was actually a pun here. And then we went in front of an asylum center, which is the biggest one in Austria, a huge thing and very important symbol. And then some activists glued themselves to the ground. But with this little thing, you know, these glue sticks?
Oh, yes.
So obviously it wasn't so fast. It was kind of a bit of a self-ironic action, but people liked it a lot, and we got a lot of laughter and a lot of coverage for this action, yeah.
That is amusing. It strikes me that, and I can understand why young people thinking, okay, I want to get into this, I want to rebel. I can understand why they would see the choice between Antifa and Extinction Rebellion and choose the latter, because Antifa, it's violent, it's dangerous, the optics aren't great. Often the people involved in it seem to be, junkies and whatever. Whereas Extinction Rebellion seems much more organized, much more well-funded, much less messy, and probably more fun to be involved with. So I can understand that Antifa would suffer next to Extinction Rebellion. What I find amazing about it, as you say, it's the elite protesting against the public, basically. It's the elite inconvenience, annoying the public, getting in the way, and trying to persuade the public, or rather just telling the public, this is what you're going to believe 5 years from now,
or
less. So this is just a foreshadow. Just get used to it now. Here's what you've got to get used to, and it probably will happen. But this gets us to the whole matter of the age that we now live in. You and I first crossed paths in 2017, and that feels now like a different age. As I said, it was all identitarianism and the alt-right and so on back then, and we were talking about Islam in Europe and mass immigration, the Great Replacement. Those were the concerns. And also Islamic terrorism was a big thing then, and I don't really understand why it's calmed down now. I don't really understand that, but it does seem to have. And now we're in this new age, which came about, I would say, in 2020 with COVID. What's your perspective on COVID and that whole thing? For me, it was really very new. I think some of us had more of an understanding of it before 2020. For me, it was a huge eye-opener. What was your perspective on COVID when it started and throughout?
But very interesting. I would really like to hear how it was an eye-opener for you or a game-changer. I agree, 2017 seems like a distant memory. Since then, what we had, these kind of events, this Black Swan, COVID. Now, COVID ends a few weeks later with a war in the east of Europe, which still going on. So it's a convergence of catastrophes, so to say, in a very bad translation from Guillaume Fay's book. COVID was very interesting in many ways because it was a huge issue that was a non-issue before. It was the politicization of healthcare, of medicine, of science in a way. And I think also the right wing struggled for quite a while to find a foothold in this issue at some point. For our structures, for organized patriotic resistance and activism, it was in one way a boost because there were the biggest mass demonstrations ever on the street in Germany and Austria who were not organized by the system, so were dissident demonstrations against the will of the power holders. Naturally, they very quickly became patriotic in a way. In Austria, they very distinctly were patriotic. So this was a boost. We got a lot of new activists. In fact, now, for example, our group in Vienna is bigger than it ever was before, also because of these demonstrations. But then, obviously, there was also a problem because this was the only issue you could talk about. You couldn't meet anymore. So a lot of structures also dissolved, like patriotic structures, because COVID was the only issue. You couldn't have your normal meetings anymore. You couldn't have any demonstration about the Great Replacement, mass migration. The subject faded away for a while. So it had a very ambivalent effect. But in the long term, I think it was a loss for the elites. A lot of people lost trust in the mainstream. It was a big boost for the counterpublic. A lot of new TV stations and newspapers popped up in Austria. And I think it's also interesting for the right wing to adapt their thinking in a way for the issue of transhumanism, of global health policy and so on. So that's my take on it. How did it open your eyes?
Oh, because I didn't realize how powerful these globalist entities actually were. The World Health Organization, mm-hmm. the World Economic Forum, the UN, the World Bank and all of that, and then BlackRock and all of this, the hedge funds. I just wasn't really aware of these things. And in retrospect, that's embarrassing for me that I feel like I should have known about more about them. But I would never have believed if someone had told me in 2019 what was about to happen and how thorough it would be and how successful it would be, how pervasive it would be, just everywhere, at all parts of society, and things that you wouldn't expect as well, like the Canada traffic cameras being shut down. I don't know if that was ever confirmed or disproven, but it was. That's one example that pops into mind. It was everything. It was the small media stations were on board with it. Museums were on board. What have museums got to do with health policy? But you couldn't get away from it. An example that I used was the Uber app. I had the actually that's to do with Ukraine, so I shouldn't bring that one in here. But the point is that even on smartphone apps that you would use, you would get stuff to do with COVID, and so exactly. COVID was suddenly everywhere.
Everywhere.
It's like you could not escape it. The example that I was going to use about Uber was the line on, but it shows you the routes that your car is going to take, and it's usually in black. But after the Ukraine war started, that route was shown in blue and yellow.
Yeah.
And that's an example of the kind of thing that started with COVID, where they've got this thing, that's this massive thing that's going on, and they will never let you forget about it. Even a silly thing like taking an Uber journey, this massive news story will be inserted into your life in this little instance. But I'm sure it was there before, but COVID was the first time where I feel like it was just, it was massive. And I do think that there were foreshadowings of it with the 2015 migrant crisis, where, and of course you and I were both talking about that at the time. We both remember it and know it well. I think what that showed was that there can be an awful lot of coordination between the governments, the police systems, the healthcare systems, the NGOs, transport networks, corporations, all of the, and of course the media. There can be a huge amount of coordination so that they make sure the public think a certain thing and believe a certain thing. And also not just public opinion management, but also the logistics of moving huge numbers of people around and then accommodating them in hotels, housing, everything. So that, I think the 2015 migrant crisis probably should have shown me more than it. I should have got more from it than I did. I should have realized we are now up against a power that is highly organized and can make connections very quickly and very effectively. And to oppose it is very difficult, because the number one thing that they've perfected is persuading the public. Or getting the public to just accept things. Manufacturing consensus, I guess, would be the term here. So that happened in 2015, and then again with COVID, and it was even bigger, I think.
That's true. And I think it's you see an increasing amount of social engineering, social technique to control the masses being done by the globalist elites. And I think there's an increasing pressure of conformity, definitely, absolutely. But it also shows, in a way, kind of a nervosity, kind of a time pressure to feel, apparently, in the globalistic projects. And I have to say, at the moment, I'm quite optimistic as a political outlook for Central Europe, for Austria, Italy, Eastern European countries, but also in the long term, Germany and France, for a possible political change, because I also think that these changes, these revolutions and coups from the top to the bottom, they're happening a bit too fast. They're too visible for people. For example, when it comes to vaccines, I was anti-vax before that because my father is kind of critical of vaccines, but it was a very fringe issue and I would never like dare to bring it up because people would see it so outlandish. Now everybody's critical of that. It's not a major issue for myself, but it's just interesting how these things get mainstream. And if you, for example, when it comes to like microchips, body modification, transhumanism, if you gradually have introduced that, you know, it would have been way easier. Imagine the smartphone would have been invented or popularized in the time of COVID. There would be an anti-smartphone movement now because they would understand how easy it is to track you with a smartphone. But it was introduced gradually in a time without any big pressure. And especially, I have to say, I think every ruling elite, even if they are doing bad things to population, it's very hard to overthrow them, to overcome them when economics are good. It's just all big changes and revolutions always happened when there was also an economic problem and issue. I, for my part, think, for example, Eastern Germany or even the whole Soviet bloc, there would have never been a revolution or a change if they had the same economic level as the West, or even not to say a better one. And here I really see a lot of changes happening now, especially in Germany, especially to Austria, due to the Ukraine war, due to deglobalization. So I think the outlook is grim economically, which paradoxically makes it politically interesting for opposition forces, be it on the right or on the left. So I would say this kind of social engineering, this kind of keeping people complacent, repression against one tiny group, seduction and bread and circuses for the other, this is will maybe not be feasible in the next decades.
Yeah, that was what I was going to get onto. I think that, as you say, COVID and the migrant crisis, these things rely on very large amounts of money to be sloshing around in order for any of this stuff to be possible. But also public opinion management, that relies on people caring and being in a position where they can care about these issues. If people are suffering, if they're struggling, then they're not going to care about, for example, things like LGBT. Am I being enough of a good trans ally this month? People are not going to care about that when they're worrying about food and heating. And this is a strange thing about the Ukraine crisis. It seems to have been, because there are some people who think that it's all been engineered, that that the Russia sanctions were deliberate. I'll be having people on Millennial, at least one who believes that this was all deliberate. What would you say about that? That they were trying to lower the quality of life.
In which way deliberate? So like can you specify this? What do you mean by deliberate?
Well, that the elites are trying to lower the quality of life for ordinary people, presumably so that they will want the pod life, so that they will want decisions taken out of their hands.
You know, I don't think so. And I'm more and more thinking that the whole COVID and Corona issue was maybe also not as planned as some people think, in a way that it was kind of a crazy overreaction and exploitation of totalitarian power, you know, because in a way it was kind of a warning shot, because they stopped now. They took a lot of things back. They even took back the vaccination mandate in Austria after a big, big wave of protest against it. So the resistance against this thing, they feel enforced. People are warned in a way. Their awareness for globalization has grown. So if I was part of a global conspiratory elite, I wouldn't act like that when it comes to COVID. So that's a bit strange. And the other thing is, for the Ukraine war, I also have to say, if I was the globalist elite with a conspiracy, I would avoid everything that rocks the boat, that shakes people up. I would just sit it out and wait it out till demographic replacement and change seals the deal. Because at some point, if you're living in many little Lebanons, multicultural, multi-ethnic failed states, then there will be no resistance against globalization because you cannot even organize a mass movement, a populist movement anymore because there's no populace left. So actually, if I'm a globalist, I would just wait like 20, 30, 40 years, keep the economy high as possible, keep the zone of indifference as large and broad as possible. This is the zone where people don't have to care about anything because it just simply doesn't touch them, you know. Keep the like one event after another, one movie after another, you know, the feed the consumers and don't create any chaos. So I think this kind of chaos that happens right now is, I don't think it's planned, and I don't see any possible scenario where this would fit in a globalist elite plan. That's my opinion, but maybe I'm just not getting the AT chess.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one thing I did want to, well, actually, there is one thing I wanted to bring up with you about COVID that you mentioned, because
by the way, sorry, just a quick question. Do you look at the chat, because there's some questions? I don't know, how do you do it here?
Oh yeah, I was going to do them at the end.
Okay, sorry. Sorry. So then I'll ignore it also till the end.
Okay, all right. One thing I wanted to bring up was something that was mentioned to me by our mutual friend Martin Lichtmes. And I wanted to get your opinion about this, that during COVID, he was in Vienna and he saw that there was propaganda about wearing the mask and social distancing and all that. And they were using patriotism as a means to persuade people to do all of this, to do the right thing. Is that not incredible that after decades of discouraging patriotism, it suddenly becomes something that they're willing to use? And I find that very interesting.
That's very interesting. And you're on point with that, because this increased even during the Ukraine war. During the Ukraine war, the Germans suddenly talk about the destiny of a people, the struggle for survival of a people, the heroism of the Ukraine heroes and only male heroes. And then Zelensky is such an amazing alpha male hero. So suddenly all these values like heroism, virility, sacrificing yourself for the fatherland, the blood of the heroes, you know, it's almost kitsch that they bring up here. Unfortunately, it's not for their own nation, but for a foreign nation. But still, it's crazy. Like, you just see how I would say, how adaptable the liberal, globalist, liberal empire is when it comes to use their pawns, you know? Like, whether it's the Saudi Arabia, which is very Islamistic, or Ukrainian nationalists who are very, very nationalistic, who would be banned in Germany within 24 hours. When they serve their goals, then it just works for them. Very, very revealing. But this nationalist appeal to nationalism for COVID, they quickly dropped it because the anti-COVID vax movement was also a very, very patriotic movement led by the Freedom Party, which, by the way, at the moment in Austria, leads the polls with 30% in the polls. National polls.
Oh, that's interesting. That's great. Well, yeah. Another aspect, similar thing to that, is the collectivism. You know, for mm-hmm. for decades we were encouraged to just see ourselves as individuals, deracinated, that no connection to other people around us. And then with COVID, suddenly everyone has a duty to the collective, to the greater good, to the community. Again, similar thing, where something gets repurposed in the service of the COVID agenda. I found that again and again. See, this is what I mean when I say that it was an eye-opener for me. Again mm-hmm. and again throughout the 2 years, things just seem to change and contradict all of the experience of my life up until then. It was incredible. Another example would be profit. I'm not really, you know, I used to think, and it used to be a cliche that it's all about the economy. And the only thing that politicians care about now is the economy and the GDP, and line must go up. But then they shut everything down for a year. and that that devastated the economy. So again, another contradiction. This stuff was incredible. But the thing I really wanted to talk to you about was, and I mentioned this to you, was the, it occurred to me that there are people in our sphere who didn't really care about COVID, or they thought it's a side issue, it's not important, it's not a big deal. And then there are people on the anti-COVID side who don't really care about nationalism, who don't really care about ethnic identity or whatever. But then there are people like you and me, and quite a few others, who cared about both issues equally. And so when COVID happened, it was a sort of natural thing to, okay, I care about my ethnic group, I care about my people, my culture, my nation, but now I also care about my liberty, my personal liberty, because something is being done to it. Something, I as an individual, I'm being violated, but this also affects everyone else as well. What would you have to say about this matter? I mean, why is it that, because people might say COVID, personal liberty is a completely different issue from ethnic identity. So therefore, why when COVID came along, did you join the anti-COVID side and throw yourself into that and become very involved in it when it's so different from your previous concerns?
Now, that's a very good question. And I would say there are two parts and levels. One is a strategic and one is an ideological one. The strategic one is, I think, the clearest and most obvious. I'm an activist. My office is the street. If there's a movement on the street, especially when it's not controlled by the mainstream and it's a dissident movement, I have to be there on the street as much involved as possible. That's what we did in Austria with great success, but also with great care. We did not try to bring our flags and our slogans into the rallies. I didn't even touch a megaphone for a long while because I didn't want them to get tainted, you know, in a way with that, and wanted them to grow as big as possible. But we helped by painting very successful and very stylish banners that always made it into the headlines, and like just helping any way we could to make them as big as possible. Because I also saw them as a very important, I would say, tutorial for the population to become more resistant. At the moment, we have the peak demonstrations in Austria, about 100,000 people, at least, you know, 50,000, but up to 100,000. And all these people learned now how to go on the street, how to paint banners, how to walk past the police line. You know, it was a kind of revolutionary tutorial. So it was very important to be there because it was creating a bigger, I would say, revolutionary resistance potential in the dissidents scene and later on the dissident right wing scene, because when this short-lived anti-COVID movement who don't really have an ideological common ground disperse, and that's happening in a way right now as being predicted, then these people are looking for other organizations and causes, and those people who were woken up to the lies of the mainstream media about COVID will now also see the reports about migration with different eyes. And that's happening left and right. On an ideological level, it wasn't just a purely strategical approach. I was first also not sure like what's going on. At first, I was also duped. I was also basically not scared, but very concerned about this virus, you know, because every country was taking part in it. And also like it's a foreign virus, comes out over the border, so it's evil, you know. that was how they were choking the mainstream before when the narrative wasn't clear. They were making fun of right-wingers who are against the foreign virus and who are fear-mongering because of COVID. Yes. Very funny.
Yeah, I remember that at the start.
You may remember that. But on the other hand, I think it's an act of globalism. It's a tool of the globalist elite. They want to have a global migration pact. They want to have a global climate policy. They want to have a global food policy. And they want to have a global health policy. So that's how I see COVID in the end. It's another tool to atomize society, to get total control over society, and to take power away from the nation and from the national governments. And on a different level, I would see it as an attack on identity, because there are several layers of identity. As an identitarian, the first and most important line of defense is my people, the national ethnocultural identity. but also the sexual identity is very much under attack, way more. We never touched the issue with GI because it wasn't so interesting. But since 2 years, we're doing a lot of actions against the global hobo ideology, because from trans kids to trans children's story hours, it's increasing. That's an attack on the sexual identity. And now with transhumanism, it's even an attack on the human identity. In a way, the COVID vaccine, the syringe that wants to cross my skin border, you know, is just a big part of this whole trans movement that wants to cross the sexual border, destroy the limits of the family, and destroy the national borders. I would say it's kind of a movement of destroying borders, population control, globalism. And therefore, I see my revolution against, or my rebellion against the COVID mandates, not so much as a liberal expression of basic rights and of libertarianism, but as an extension of an identitarianism.
Oh, wow. That's a very interesting way to look at it. So you see globalism as something that is opposed to dignity and sanctity. Meaningful.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's opposed to everything that's exclusive. They want to make everything inclusive and therefore meaningless. Everything that has a border, every identity, every group identity that has some kind of border, and say, okay, there it stops. No, that's like, a family is a man and a woman, you know, a man is a man, or a German is a German, but also like a human is a human, you know. No, they want to cross every border, they want to blur every line, they want to create, turn everything into this human resource, you know, this biomass globally. And here I also, as I think COVID completely and the global health policy completely fits the whole issue, but still, like, I have to add, I still think the Great Replacement is a way bigger threat than the global health policy and the COVID regime.
That's interesting, because some people have, I guess, moved away from the Great Replacement to COVID and the World Economic Forum and so on. Why would you say that the Great Replacement is a bigger threat? I mean, is that simply because we can't come back from being replaced?
Exactly. It's irreversible, but also because the only tool we have against globalism is the people, the nation state at the moment. The only way to counter this COVID policy is not to flee from it, because you can't flee anywhere. Even when you go to South America, it hits you there. So the only way is to organize, and the only way to successfully organize against a global policy is on a national scale. Only the nation state can secure us on a meaningful level from all these kind of population control mechanisms. And if we lose the national state, we lose any possibility to have any influence on the course of history, on the development of technology, transhumanism, and so on. It's our own only political tool. And the basis for the nation state is the people in its identity and relative homogeneity. So I think if you destroy the people, you also destroy any possibility for any different health policy or national health policy that in the future might resist COVID. So In a paradoxical move, I would prefer Hungary, where Orban had kind of a strict COVID policy for several reasons. I know some Hungarian who explained it to me. But a very strict migration policy, like a very good migration policy, I prefer this to Sweden, which has had the best COVID policy in Europe, but at this time still the worst migration policy, you know, because in Hungary, people can recover from that. We can recover from a bad health policy. We can recover from a bad transgender education schedule. We can change all of this in the future if we achieve a political victory. But from population replacement, and that's actually, yeah, you're right. That's just your argument. It's irreversible, and that's why it's the major threat.
Yeah, it's an existential threat. Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah, I agree. Okay, well, that's an interesting overview of this, because these are two, as I said beforehand, these are two very different issues, and yet they interact and intersect in very strange ways. Okay, well, I'll get to the super chats if that's fine with you. Somebody's asking me to pronounce the word Muslim. I know it can also be pronounced Muslim. I don't know, whatever, it's tomato, really. Okay, Cat Hugger asks you, serious question. Martin, how do you not get blackpilled?
Oh, yeah. by looking at my son, you know, it's kind of a big cheer up every day in my life. Yeah, but I just disagree to get blackpilled. I think there's hope always. We have to fight for a Reconquista. If you can't find for a Reconquista, then we have to fight for kind of a secession or a different mode of survival, even if we don't achieve to stop the Great Replacement before a tipping point of democracy. Then we fight for the survival of identity in a different way. We're still millions, and we will definitely survive this century, and we'll definitely outlive this crazy ideology. And the more we can save, the better. So I think that I'm not dooming at all. Also, I think we're now in the only real revolutionary movement that wants a change, the only movement that really stands for truth and integrity. Also, since we have nothing to lose and we can't be bought, we are completely outside of the system. So I think it's totally the right place to be in, being involved in this movement, whether you are like on the front or on the back. So I think it's just still something that's the only thing to live an authentic and real life. And Greek philosophers said that's the only way of happiness. It's not a state you're in and out, or like something you can induce with drugs or money. It's the knowledge of doing the right thing. And that's why I refuse to get black pills. So yeah, that's my approach.
All right. That's a very good answer. Okay, Insightful World asks the following. Martin, do you do activism in Western Austria? I know that there are many people in Vorarlberg who completely agree with you, but are, of course, not as affected as the Viennese or the Tyroleans.
Yeah, it's by the way, it's pronounced Vorarlberg.
I'm sorry.
It's a good attempt. No, it's a good attempt. Yeah, yes. There's an activistic group in Tyrol, which is I would consider identitarian. It's called Haimon. You can visit their page. I'll write in the chat. I'm also here on Odyssey. But in Vorarlberg at the moment, which is the smallest part of Austria, there's no real, like, no group, but maybe you should go to Tyrol and visit their page once and connect with them. But yeah, greetings to Vorarlberg from Vienna.
Okay. All right. Another lost in Western, I can't read the whole name, sorry. Do you still need help in the research department? I refer to your posts on Telegram a while ago and your appeal for people to email you. I haven't heard back from you. Nevertheless, thank you for all you do for all of us. I hope to shake your hand one day.
Oh, yeah, I hope so too. Yeah, like there's still like some journalistic projects going on. And but they're mostly German speaking. So, but you can still write me. I just also put my email, my homepage in the chat again. There, find my email address. Just hit me up on email, then we can talk about the details.
All right. Let me just check these other. Okay. Remember that during World War II, the USSR regime used patriotism to energize the Russian people. In Russia, World War II is called the Great Patriotic War. The regime will use any means at their disposal to maintain power and stay alive. Indeed, I think that's a clear fact at this point. All right, Winston says, great guest. Good luck, Martin, on all the future work and endeavours that you and your group and its members do going into the next year and thereafter. I hope that you, your family, and Colin as well have a very Merry Christmas. Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Winston. He also says, Martin is Austrian. How does he... thank you, we are aware. How does he view the Freedom Party of Austria? Are they based or conservative? Are they anti-COVID vax? If so, why don't they team up with the other vaccine-hesitant party in your country? The Freedom Party.
Very good question. The Freedom Party, like I'll answer the last question first, was anti-vax, and they took part in the anti-vax demonstration, which saved them a lot of trouble. The AfD did not do that, and they just created some counter-parties and a lot of disruption, but they didn't do it enough. But still, there was an anti-vax party, which is like a single-issue anti-vax party, even distanced themselves a bit from the Freedom Party. they did their job, because in regional election, the Conservative Party lost a lot of votes to them, but now they're disappearing. They had a candidate running in the presidential election who like completely blew it, and they now try to quickly rebrand themselves as being anti-immigration, which they weren't before. And this will also probably not work, so I don't see any future for them. And obviously the Freedom Party just has to wait it out, especially since at the moment, like wait this party out, I guess, because at the moment they have in the polls, as I said before, 30%, they're the strongest party. Kickl, the leader of the Freedom Party, is the favorite chancellor at the moment of the Austrian people. Reason for this is the big migration wave that we're experiencing right now. And I would say the Freedom Party is based, and it's one of the most based right-wing parties in Europe, because they're really talking about all the issues. They are demanding remigration. So word for word, so that's a word that they're using very often. There was even a remigration tour of the youth of the Freedom Party during summer. Last 2 weeks ago, they even had a remigration party in one of their youth locations in Indiana. And they published a very important page. I will also link it in the chat. Look at it. It's published by the youth movement of the Freedom Party. It's called Bevölkerungsaustausch.de, also replacement, population replacement. And here you see for every region of Austria, Germany, and Switzerland, you can click through the years, per years and by decades, when how the population replacement takes place, when it will take place. It's animated, but the important thing is you can even change the parameters. You can see how the whole thing would develop if we had less migration and more births. And you can just see it's shocking in a way, but it's also giving you a lot of hope. And this is something no other party in Europe has done. So I think the Freedom Party now is really on a very good direction. And that's, I would say, it's only because of Kickl, who, in my opinion, is the best right-wing politician in Europe, because he's very intelligent, acts very strategic, is very clear, very structured. He doesn't have this histrionic complex that a lot of right-wing leaders have. And also, he doesn't distance himself at all from anyone.
All right. Oh, excellent. Pox Populi asks, what are your thoughts on European separatist and independence movements such as in Catalonia, Scotland, and Northern Italy? Should the nationalist right be more amicable to the idea of separatism as a counter against globalism?
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. Obviously, I'm for Scottish independence, you know. okay. No, the problem is, I think it's complicated, because very often the separatist movements are completely subverted by left-wingers in a way. So not often, like very often, they're not at all for ethnocultural identity, but they're just for a different separation of power to gain personal power. You know, naturally, as an identitarian, I have kind of a sympathy with independence movement, whether it's the movement on Corsica or the best country or any kind of region, because I see it as an expression of the will of survival for a certain region. But to be honest, I don't see a big chance at the moment in those movements. And I also don't see this big urgency, because especially, like, for example, if you look at South Tyrol, which is still a part of Italy, which hurts me as an Austrian, obviously, because there are Tyroleans living there, it's Austrian. And these people, when they, for example, take part in the Olympics as skiers, they always ski for Italy with completely Austrian names. But still, the biggest problem there is also the population replacement. And the population replacement there is not being done by Italians, who have the same low birth rate as all the others. So I see, if the separatist movements want to maintain a regional identity, the biggest threat for this regional identity at the moment is not the centralist foreign state, which is not so foreign after all, if you look at the British man and the Scottish man, an Italian and an Austrian, but the population replacement by complete foreigners. So I would say those separatist movements, I understand it, and I think it's still something that should be debated. They should keep their identity. The state should give them all the right to maintain their languages, their traditions, you know, the Moors. But if they're not at the same time fighting against population replacement with the same or even more vigor, then they are complete hypocrites and should not be supported.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a huge thing with Sinn Féin in Ireland and the SNP in Scotland, the Scottish National Party, that they they're obsessed with, like, with the SNP are obsessed with splitting from England, but that's really it. They don't actually have any love or affection for Scotland, for the Scottish people, for Scottish culture, because they want. And I made this point. You know, they don't care about Scottish culture because they want multiculturalism. They don't care about the Scottish people as an ethnic group because they want mass immigration. They don't even care about Scottish sovereignty and independence because they want Scotland in the European Union. So it's difficult. I don't know anything. What is it that they actually want to protect? What is it that they actually like about Scotland? Not the people, not the culture, not the sovereignty, the government. Nothing.
I think in this case, it's really only about grabbing power. Because they would get more money, you know, they maybe use it as a way to extort more money from the central state. You know, maybe you don't give us the independency, but we get keep more taxes and get more funding. So I think it's a pure money and power play at this point. You know.
Yes, I think so. I mean, again, it's a status quo that is being held on to, no matter what. Okay, Arklo asks whether I've ever been to Austria. He says, beautiful country, visit Hallstatt, an actual slice of heaven. Well, I have been to Austria once, 5 years ago. I was in Vienna, and it was beautiful. I couldn't believe how lovely it. And I'm not just saying this because I'm speaking to Martin Sellner. It really was. I mean, it was one beautiful building after another. After another, wherever you looked. Now, I'm sure that there are bad parts of Vienna, but I didn't see them. That's the point I'm making.
They are bad parts of Vienna.
Gorgeous city.
It's a pretty city, definitely. I'm not very objective here, obviously, but I really have to say it's beautiful. But also, I would say, like, my favorite cities of Europe are Vienna, Budapest, and Prague, from Czech Republic, Hungary, and Austria. Because I think they're very pretty, they're quite untouched by the war, and they're not so overrun with tourism like you have it with Paris and Rome and others.
I've never been to Budapest or Prague. There's a story about that I've tried to go to Prague twice, and both times it hasn't worked out for silly reasons. I don't really understand why. But as for Budapest, I should have gone there. I mean, this is a thing about COVID that it just stopped all this travel. You know,
true.
I hope to see these places one day, and Vienna again. I loved Vienna. The Estonian. So the Estonian says, great podcast and great guest. Although I might be a bit biased, since I seem to have a thing for Austrian activists. Well, thank you very much. And then Defiant Irishman says, all Sinn Féin want is a 32 county republic that they are in charge of. They don't care what goes on in this 32 county republic or who lives in it. It's just depressing. What can I say? You would want politicians who care about the country that they're looking after and the people that they're serving. This just seems to be obvious stuff. Well, that's all the questions over with. So I don't think I missed any. If I did, I apologize. Are there any final things you'd like to say about what you do? And how people can help you, how people can support you, and any words for the audience?
Yeah, was very nice to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. There was very interesting and good questions. Also nice for me to be on English podcast and stream again. Way to practice my English a bit, because during COVID, a lot of contacts also had fell asleep a bit, all of these conversations. I think it's very important to not get blackpilled and not mourn and complain about the situation we're in. I think it's actually a very interesting time. I think it's a way better time to live in than to live in the post-war time between the 40s and now, because actually I think not much could have happened there. Doesn't matter what you do and how you organize things, because it was the peak time of the economy and consumerism. And I don't think we should wish those times back, but we should approach and we should embrace what is coming and try to use those the crisis and the problems that we're facing as a chance to change something. That would be my message to the people. Also, some kind of a Christmas spirit. If you want to do something, obviously, most people who are watching probably don't have an activist movement in their neighborhood, but I think what everybody can do is to try to connect to other people, try to create a little patriotic community, a little cell of resistance that also gives them strength and support in their region. I think that's something that everybody can do, and everybody's able to do that, and I think everybody should do that. Obviously, if you're in Germany, Austria, France, Denmark, or Hungary or another European country, you should get active in contact with your local identitarian movement and join them.
Okay. All right. Well, Martin Sellner, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. I'll be back in 45 minutes with the next stream, but this has been a really interesting and enjoyable one. So thank you very much. Okay. Excellent. I will see you all in a little while. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.